Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
We have a website, icba.org, and a lot of our materials are online. So you can go on and look at our press releases and policy positions and letters and so forth. So,
talking about resources through the Independent Community Bankers of America, it's Mark Scanlon.
We have quite an array of materials covering the full banking regime that is before Congress that we're working with, and also we work a lot with regulators on new regulations, and then just a number of educational items as well. So at that website, www.icba.org, you'll find a lot of our materials.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Our farmers are hurting. Increased input costs, high interest rates, and depressed commodity prices have created dire conditions in rural America.
With less than 12 days left in this congressional session, farmers are hurting. There's no farm bill. And the next chairman of the Senate Ag Committee, Dr. John Bozeman, on the floor of the Senate Monday.
Farmers, lenders, and community leaders in all regions of the country are saying the same thing. Farmers desperately need help. When you look at the numbers, it's clear the pain our farm families are living through. As of the end of November, row crop farmers nationwide are projected to lose more than $29 billion. Corn growers will lose more than $11 billion. Soybean producers will lose $5.7 billion. And wheat farmers will lose more than $5 billion. The numbers aren't better for other commodities. Cotton, sorghum, rice, and peanut producers are ending 2024 with projected average losses over $200 per acre. The reality behind these losses is even more worrisome. For some producers, this is the second or third consecutive year of negative cash flow. This means many farm families are ending 2024 in the red, unable to pay off this year's operating loan, unable to get the loan to farm in 2025, and face the reality of being the next generation to have lost the family farm due to extreme market conditions beyond their control. One Arkansas farmer recently shared that he had the best crop yield of his career, but he's still underwater because commodity prices are well below the cost of production. Even for producers who haven't seen severe losses in 2024, the concern for 2025 continues to escalate as margins are forecast to remain poor. In the last few months, there's been a significant shift in the spirit of our farmers. After years of unprecedented challenges, they are discouraged and pleading for stronger tools to help survive these conditions. Farm groups are sounding the alarm. The American Farm Bureau says there are clear economic warning signs of need in rural America. The Agriculture of Arkansas President Nathan Reed described the conditions in the natural state of farmers as facing, quote, virtually impossible to net anything but a significant loss, regardless of crop, yield, or safety net coverage, end quote. The severity of these losses has left many producers questioning if they have a future in farming. Established farmers are hesitant to risk what little equity remains, while young and beginning farmers don't have the capital necessary to survive these conditions.
It appears almost impossible that any help could come this year.
If Congress does not act appropriately, I worry many of these producers may not be around next year. Agriculture is an important part of our country's heritage and our economy. Our producers grow an abundant and affordable supply of food and fiber. They must have the tools that they need to manage this extremely difficult market. We must help our farmers recover from the sizable losses they realized in 2024 and give them certainty for 2025. This assistance is crucial to the viability of agriculture in the United States.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
One of the number one things I want to accomplish tonight is please let there be some of our incoming members, their future staff, the members themselves, listening.
Arizona Representative David Schweikert continues to sound the alarm on the nation's debt.
I know there's no one in the room. That's the way it's supposed to be. People are supposed to be in their meetings and reading and trying to understand what's going on. So don't fuss at people for not sitting here. We're on probably 1,000 televisions around the Capitol campus. But one of my frustrations is we just got off election season. Would you believe during elections, people, make crap up. We need to have an honest discussion about something called math. So let's actually have some fun. If you ever have someone say, we're going to grow ourselves out of the debt and deficit. Okay, let's actually do some math off the top of our heads. This year's debt is going to be a couple $1 trillion. How much would the economy have to grow to produce enough tax receipts to cover $2 trillion? It's actually fairly simple math. 1 point of GDP is about $300 billion, okay? So you get about 17-18% of GDP in tax receipts. So let's see if 300 billion, 17%, $48 billion. So if I, 1% of GDP growth only gets me $48 billion, you do realize that means you'd in a single year have to have like 40, 41, 42% GDP growth to cover the debt deficit of this year. It's absurd. I beg of people, learn your math. Don't let the political consultants who make crap up and then put it on our brochures and then tell you to go out and say it. It's now time to do adult-like math. And the understanding, and I'm going to do this 3 or 4 times tonight, Every dime of deficits from today through the next 30 years is the very thing we're not supposed to talk about. It's demographics. We got older as a society. Our brothers and sisters who worked their 40 quarters, who paid into the system, they now start to get their benefits. If you actually look at the inputs of debt, the last decade, but particularly what we expect the next 3 decades, healthcare, Medicare, interest, and then 9 years from now, do we backfill Social Security or do we double senior poverty when the trust fund's emptied? And we're not supposed to talk about those things. And I will actually, I need to share something. I believe the Democrats engaged in something, I won't call it evil, but absolutely dystopian and cruel. When they basically attacked members of the Republican Party for actually talking about ways to save Social Security. So just even mentioning it, having the conversation, they just do an attack ad on it. And then you wonder why they come back and say, well, we need bipartisanship. We're going to work together. Except you're not allowed to actually say anything that actually has a basis in a calculator. It's perverse. Do you want to save? Is the left actually okay in 9 years of doubling poverty of seniors in America? We already have reports right now of baby boomers who've retired becoming homeless because of the inflationary cycle we just went through, not being able to pay their rent. It's just this level of cruelty, and the solution isn't spending more and more and more money because we don't have it.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I would remind you the timber losses alone in Florida were $1 billion. Ultimately, the disaster package was about $3 billion. Nobody was made anywhere close to whole with what we did.
Last year, Georgia Representative Austin Scott, a member of the House Ag Committee, on hurricane relief.
Ad hoc disaster relief is not the way to provide a risk management tool for our farmers and our farm families. It takes too long for it to get to them. If they were totally dependent on ad hoc disaster relief, to be honest with you, they would probably be broke before it ever got to them. And so crop insurance and that system is the best thing that we can do for production agriculture. And that at least gives them the cash to make it through until any ad hoc disaster relief may be there. But again, you can't count on ad hoc disaster relief. You know, we need the commodity title. We need the crop insurance title. It accounts for 0.2% of total federal spending. It does tremendous amounts of good for our rural economies and our farm base in this country. And without those two things, I don't think you'll see production agriculture survive into the next generation. You may see corporate agriculture, but you won't see the farm family continuing to be out there doing what they do today, getting on the tractor and taking the risk that they take to grow a crop, to put that crop on the shelves for those of us in this country. The risk will just outweigh what they can handle financially.
Still no farm bill, which means no new title for rural development.
They're extremely important, especially if you represent rural America as I do. I represent, you know, all or parts of 29 counties. The majority of those counties are rural counties. Without agriculture, you don't have the tax base for a school system or a city or a county in those rural counties. You don't have the tractor dealerships, the car dealerships, or the restaurants. And so in those communities where agriculture is the economy, it is 100% of the economy. Everything else is dependent upon it. So the grants through USDA, all of those things are important, but nothing is as important to me as the crop insurance and the commodity title. Without that, rural America is going to suffer. Over the last couple of years, we've seen the SNAP benefit portion of the farm bill move from 65% all the way up to, it looked like it was going to be 85%, and now it's back down to about 81%. So we now have to, whether it be USDA grants, whether it be CRP-type programs or conservation programs, or the commodity support and the crop insurance programs, those things used to get a combined about 35 to 40% of the farm bill. Now those things combined are going to get somewhere around 18% of the farm bill. And so it is absolutely going to put significant pressure on all aspects of those other titles in the farm bill. You take that coupled with the fact that you have some Democrats, not all Democrats, but some Democrats that want to add what they're calling an environmental title to the farm bill. And where would they take that money from? They're not going to take it from the SNAP benefits. So they would try to stick another title in there and take more from those things that those of us in rural America actually need. And we need to make it through. We needed to make it through, you know, this year and next year and the following year. So very concerned about the approach of some on the extreme left to it. Very concerned about the approach of some on the extreme right to it. And, Tony, we're just going to, you know, we're going to outwork them. We're going to keep going on a daily basis, and we're going to beat them with the truth.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The feeding entity, the feeding segment or industry in the beef industry is is a portion where we're finishing that product. We're finishing that live animal that will go on and be, you know, procured and processed by the packing industry. And turn into wholesome beef for the consumer.
Robbie Kirkland is with Kirkland Feed Yard in Vega, Texas, explaining the role that feeders play in that beef chain. He's also chairman of the Texas Cattle Feeders.
You know, our role, we take cattle in from anywhere from, you know, 400 pounds to 900 pounds, let's say. And then, you know, our job is to put efficient weight gain on those animals and get them to a point that they are adequately finished and in a safe and healthy, wholesome way. And for us to, you know, be able to market them and be a great product for the consumer to go and enjoy.
And says it's not unlike other producers, dealing with weather can be challenging.
For example, I mean, this November has been a challenging one. October actually is, you know, typically a really challenging time for feed yard. Just lots of cattle movement. Usually can be a little bit dusty. And you get a lot of cattle just moving throughout the United States, just as a, part of the cyclical movement of cattle in the U.S. And so, we came through October really pretty good. We came into November, fairly dry from a moisture standpoint. And then we began to get rains, and we got rains the first week of November, and then we dried out a little bit. and got more rains in the middle part of November. And so that's been challenging. It's been cold. We have had a little bit of snow. So like you said, we've kind of gone from probably we were in the low 90s the end of October to, you know, we've had freezes now. We've been down and into the high 20s. So it's cooled off a lot in 30 days. And like I said, a lot of that's been accompanied with moisture. And that is, which is nice for your farm, nice for the you know, the growing crops, but it is challenging for feedlots and those running cattle.
The Texas Panhandle region can go from hot to cold nearly in a matter of hours.
Cattle do handle it well. One thing about our feed yard, it's a, you know, maybe a little different, but we handle a lot of southeasterns, you know, from Texas through the Gulf region. So those cattle are adapted to handle heat a little better, handle a lot of cattle from, like I said, the coastal region all the way to Florida. And so those cattle handle heat better. You're right. It did get hot this summer and it is a challenge. You know, the one thing we always talk about in the Texas Panhandle that's really unique is there's always wind. If you come up here, you'll see some wind turbines, and they don't put those here because the wind doesn't blow. It's the wind blows a little. We keep a good breeze. And what's always critical in the summertime is for us to drop our temperatures down into the 60s at night. That's always something we're monitoring and watching. And so very rarely do we ever get that we don't drop our you know, nighttime temps down into the high 60s. And we know whenever we don't, that sometimes can be a critical point in time. But you know, most of the time, that's a key factor for us.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
At what point does the bond market come in here and say, hey, you guys are, by the end of the decade, approaching 9%+ of the entire economy in borrowed money? Maybe we need a higher interest rate.
Arizona Representative David Schweikert sounding the alarm on the debt.
Has anyone paid attention to the bond market the last 3 weeks? Have you noticed that even though the Fed started to lower interest rates, we're still sitting 4.5 on a 10? Anyone understand that's almost a full point higher than we expected at this point in the cycle? Do you understand what 1 point of interest means? Today, interest is the second biggest expense in the federal government. Last fiscal year, it was 14.1% of all of our spending was just interest. We have an economist as part of the Joint Economic Committee, and we're trying to model, saying at what point does interest and the obligation to pay it start to consume so much of our future, and then you get yourself in the debt spiral where interest rates keep going up because you're considered riskier, and you just are in this interest trap, and you almost don't have enough to cut. And we're going to show that to actually deal with the interest trap. A point of reference, forgive me for taking a sip, before I lose my voice again. Think of this. The United States is number 14 on the credit stack, meaning there's 13 other countries that can sell a 10-year bond cheaper than we can. When Greece today can sell a 10-year bond cheaper than the United States, when Greece today is actually paying down its debt from the last decade, and we're borrowing $71,000 a second. Anyone see a problem? But how many people have you seen come behind these mics? How many people on the election trail stood up in front of you and said, we got a problem? I can stand here and promise you all sorts of stuff by your vote that we have absolutely no money to pay for, so we're going to just put it on your retirement or your kid's credit card, because that's what we're doing. And understand, we've almost made a decision that in the next couple of years, Congress isn't going to run this government. The president is going to run this government. The bond market. Last year, we had to bring almost $10 trillion to market. $2 trillion virgins, new issuances, and everything else was refinanced. And if anyone's just of a finance or bond geek, the bonds we're issuing, we've been staying very short on the curb, meaning we refinance, 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 means as we can become very fragile to little hiccups in interest. God forbid the bond vigilantes figure out some way to start to screw with U.S. sovereigns. But this is important. This is just the baseline math. 9 budget years, 9.2% of this economy will just be what we borrow in debt. And this is a calculation with no wars, no pandemics, no recessions. Do you really think we're going to go the next decade without a moment when the wheels are coming off? We're living on the edge. And yet, do our brothers and sisters, do our new incoming freshman class understand how dangerous, how fragile we're about to make the greatest republic in human history? Remember, the world, this is more just not only the United States, the world needs the United States to be prosperous. Prosperity is moral, and we're squandering it.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
So Kansas State University, and this was actually, I would say, a legacy of Senator Roberts.
Representative Sharice Davids from Kansas is a member of the House Ag Committee.
And making sure that when it comes to protecting, because, you know, our food system, and making sure that our farmers and producers are able to continue to produce not just food that feeds us and the world, but also there are so many other aspects of energy production and these sorts of things that when it comes to our national defense, we have to make sure that we're not just researching those areas, but also protecting against any kind of nefarious activities. And so, yeah, this research and defense program that's out there is fits very neatly into that. And Senator Roberts was one of the key drivers of making sure that we have one of those here in the United States.
When we think of food security or insecurity, we often think of inner cities.
Most people don't understand that a lot of the struggles in rural America mirror inner city, lower socioeconomic issues.
Texas Representative Jasmine Crockett is a member of the House Ag Committee and represents an inner city, Bonton.
You talk about Bonton and it just lights me up because Bonton Farms is really this amazing kind of bright spot in my district, right? But the conception for it was the fact that in my district, which is inner city, we experience food deserts. And we know that if there's a food desert, that also affects whether or not you've got positive or negative health outcomes. Because our food is our medicine, right? And so it affects whether or not, say, your obesity levels. It affects, and honestly, we know how many illnesses come along with obesity. And so we know that you have a higher likelihood to end up in the hospital. So it's bigger than just the fact that, hey, I've got to eat, you know, Fritos instead of necessarily having an apple. We're talking about your life expectancy. We're talking about my kiddos and the lack of the development, the full development of their minds. We know that food is so much more crucial to those itty bitty minds to make sure that they are learning and maximizing their learning opportunities. And so it's a big issue in rural America as well as urban America. And when we look at it, it comes down to profits, right? And I'm not against anybody making money. I mean, I'm not against that. We live in a capitalist society for sure, but I can't force a grocer to come in when they say, hey, looking at these numbers, we just can't make the profits. We will go under. But there should be other options. And so, you know, we're hoping that we can get legislation passed that would allow for co-ops to be able to invest in themselves and say, you know what, we don't have the money ourselves, but if we can go and get this loan, then maybe we can fill in the gaps and help out in some of these food deserts and better the health outcomes for our communities. That way, we're not relying upon, say, this for-profit organization to come in, this for-profit organization that has never wanted to come in, right? Because if they did, they would have been there. It's crucial. And we know that when you're looking at a food desert, you're also dealing with the health deserts as well as the educational deserts. Like, people end up leaving because they just don't have access to the basics that they need.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The background of the Agriculture Secretary nominee. In her own words, per a 2019 National Review Institute Ideas Summit, starting with her childhood hometown.
Called Glen Rose, Texas. It's a population of 1,200 people. I had 29 people in my graduating class from my public high school. I left in 1990 to attend Texas A&M University on an agriculture scholarship, thanks to the Future Farmers of America. And you know, it never occurred to me that I couldn't someday be in the White House. I have moved to the White House to run the Office of American Innovation, and I'm an assistant to the president for strategic initiatives, working on pretty much everything domestic policy.
Brooke Rollins would later serve as acting director of the U.S. Domestic Policy Council in the Trump administration. She awaits confirmation as President-elect Donald Trump's agriculture secretary by Congress after her nomination Thanksgiving week. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.